Bonjour, hi, Canada. That music means a Hillsdale dialogue is at hand. Dr. Larry Arnn is with me, president of Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale are collected at hillsdale.edu. If you become a supporter of Hillsdale, you'll get invited to a fascinating thing that they do three times a year. They bring in a bunch of old people to mix it up with the young people, and they have a conference on something. And I'm always invited in the winter because no one else wants to go in the winter up in Hillsdale. And the one time I went and I gave a talk about Washington, and at the end of that, I really couldn't put my arms around Washington. I just listed his characteristics. Dr. Arnn came up to me and said, the word you are missing is rectitudinous. And I've never forgotten that. I don't know if you remember that, but rectitudinous is exactly what Washington was. And as I read his first inaugural address and his farewell address, I am again amazed at the character of the man. And I will stipulate, he held slaves. He understood that to be not sinful when he ought to have understood it to be sinful, or perhaps you'll correct me on that. And his theology is of a mixed sort, though people disagree with me. But his rectitudinousness is without parallel except for Lincoln.
You can just say rectitude, by the way.
Okay.
So slavery, you bring that in. Washington liberated his slaves upon the death of Martha. And he, in his adult life, when he spoke of it as an evil, and often, not as eloquently as Jefferson, because he wasn't as eloquent as Jefferson. But it's a fact that he did not liberate his slaves except upon his death, Martha's death, actually, after him. just remember, so George Washington is born in 1732, and he grows up in a world where there's slavery all around, which is, by the way, most of human history. And coming to think that that's wrong is part of the education that the colonies went through on the way to the American Revolution, because they came to understand that the rightful basis of government is the one that they were actually using in North America, representation and equal rights. And slaves don't have equal rights. And so by the time of 1776, there's a consensus that this slavery thing is bad. We don't know what to do about it. We can't quite imagine living with these slaves or former slaves as equal citizens. It took a long time for people to think that that could be done, and it's difficult to do even today. But, I'll interject. I had the great Bob Woodson, who's a friend of mine of 40 years and a black man, a wonderful man. And what he does is he goes into the inner city and he meets people, mostly Christians, and he develops with them and broadcasts with them the theme that the solution to the problems of the urban poor is chiefly in the hearts and souls of the urban poor. And that what we can do is remove obstacles, and we must do that, but that they should get their lives in order. So anyway, that's a...
Let me pause for a second. When you said it's difficult to do even today, I want to guard you against the social media terrorists who exist, who come after people who express a fully formed idea in shorthand. I think you're saying that equal opportunity and the constitutional rights, so that the republic governs everyone regardless of race, as Martin Luther King said, on the content of their character, not the color of their skin, is hard to do even today, 50, 60, 70 years into the recognition by the Supreme Court and Brown v. Board that separate could not be equal.
That's what I mean. And you know, the point is there are racial divisions among us. I'm just saying that. And holding to the principles of the Declaration of Independence, I think that's a shame, and I feel a duty to do what I can about it. There are wonderful, hopeful signs, as there have been since the abolition of slavery.
But there are bad signs too. This is not Washington at all. We'll come back to it. But last week, the Wall Street Journal published an editorial saying, please, Supreme Court, take the Harvard case because they are discriminating against Asian Americans and they're not even hiding it very well. And they are discriminating against them because they don't want the campus to be too Asian American. Well, that's discrimination on the basis of race, and it's wrong. And so
that's right.
It ought to be banned. It ought to be banned because they're doing race balancing. Justice Roberts in the Seattle case said the answer to discriminating against on the evil of it, discriminating on race is to not discriminate on the basis of race. It's really pretty simple, but it requires courage. Let's go back to Washington. I put the slavery in there just so that the audience would know we are not unaware of that. But his greatness is not in freeing his slaves after Martha's death. His greatness is in creating a country. And do you agree with me? He is the indispensable man.
Oh, yeah. Everybody thought that at the time. Because there was a, you know, it, as in France, there were enormous, they, you know, they were doing something new. They were building a wholly representative government. And they'd never had that because the king was not a representative person. And so who are we going to trust with the king's power? And now you have to back up a step. How did George Washington get the reputation that he could be trusted with the presidency, a very powerful office? And that he developed through his life. He was very brave and steadfast on battlefields. And the very difficult, 1776 to 1783, the Revolution War went on, and it was terrible, and it was mostly bad news. And he was steadfast through all of that. And he suffered with the troops. Sometimes his wife came to stay at Valley Forge. She spent extensive time at Valley Forge in that terrible winter where they were freezing to death and starving. And so, you know, they loved him. And then he embellishes his by the way, his character is commanding and reserved, right? That's of the three greatest Democratic statesmen I know, Washington, Lincoln, and Churchill. He's the one who had that combination the most. He was a very fiery man. People who knew him best knew that, but he kept control of himself. And it was, you know, just remarkable how. And so all of those episodes inspired trust in him. He was trustworthy, and obviously. And then, you know, after they win, and just think what a excitement that was, especially in the army, because, you know, they'd just been mostly putting it together with chewing gum and barbed wire, and they didn't know how to be an army, didn't have any stuff, right? And then they won. And so that's a great thing. And, you know, there are people wanted him to be king, and he takes that movement down at Newbury after the war is won. And, you know, another thing is Congress is a vital and important institution, and also it's extremely annoying, and always. And so they never got around to paying the army that won the Revolutionary War. And the army is getting kind of rebellious. And so they have a thought, and it's a wonderful American kind of revolutionary thought. It shows how strong were the principles of the country. They didn't propose to march on Washington and get their money, or to Philadelphia would have been then. They proposed to march out west and leave everybody struggling and left to their own devices, right? And Washington intercepted all that. And he and at the same time, there were these letters circulating in the camp and getting out into the press that soldiers wanted Washington to be king. And at Newbury, he went and gave a wonderful talk. And the basic point of the talk, the famous talk, is what have we been fighting for here? And then he does a wonderful Washington thing. The first thing he did was he pauses and puts on his spectacles. And he says, pardon me, my eyes have dimmed while serving with you, something like that. And then in his speech, he goes along and then he says, in this matter of your pay, I will be your servant, right? So he's showing that we all have to be servants before the public good, and he sets the example. That's why he's easy to follow, right? And the political party system in America burst on the scene, obviously on the scene in 1800, the election of 1800, after Washington had retired. And the people who were divided up into the parties were the makers of the American Revolution. Great people all, most of them.
He held back that storm. When we come back, he held back that storm by with Washington. When we come back, you have to tell the George III story, because there are some people who have not heard it, and it so perfectly frames George Washington. And then we have to do the first inaugural address and his farewell speech, because in those 8 years is contained multitudes. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The Hillsdale Dialogue is underway.
It's another non-stop, action-packed information blitz.
Kind of makes you tingle, doesn't it?
Hang on. Hugh Hewitt will be right back.
Welcome back, America. The Hillsdale Dialogue is underway. Dr. Larry Arnn and I are talking about one of his favorite statesmen, George Washington, and his first inaugural address and his farewell address 8 years apart. But before we get there, he leaves the army, retires to Mount Vernon. And George III, whom I think hated Washington, I'm reading at the recommendation of George W. Bush on this show 6 weeks ago, The British Are Coming, Rick Atkinson's wonderful history of the Revolutionary War. And George III really loathed the people who tried to break up his empire. And Washington had to be among them, though I have no specific evidence for that. If you can, tell us the story of George III and Washington at the conclusion of the war.
Well, after the war, the Revolutionary War ends in 1783, and the Treaty of Paris, which formally ended the war, is 2 years later. And the Prime Minister says we have to organize a peace conference here. And George III doesn't want to do it, and he comes to him several times. And by the way, this story, it's widely believed because the reports of it are so persistent back to the time. But there's not a document that says this. So Martin Gilbert would require me to say that. The Prime Minister went to him and said, "Sir, we have to call a peace conference." And you know what George III is thinking is, I've lost the New World, right? And he looks up at him and says, at the Prime Minister, and says, "George Washington will not know how to be a king. He will be a tyrant, and the people will call for me back." And the Prime Minister replied, "I understand that General Washington has resigned his commission and gone home." And George III stirred a little and said, "If he's done that, he's the greatest living man." Well, that's, because just think, but the natural calculus, right? The Hanovers, George III was a Hanover, monarchs invited from Germany. And they get to be the monarchs of England through a series of events reaching back, 1,000 years to Alfred. But in general, when there's a change of the house of the monarchy, it's because of a conquest. It's because somebody won a battle and killed the other guys, right?
Yes.
And so that's the way it works, right? That's what you think. My son will get to do it, and his son will get to do it, and his son will get to do it, unless they're about to kill him. Right. And then the ones who kill them, they get to be the one. Right. And that's the calculus. Right. And George Washington, by his example and action, upset that calculus. And George III, by this report, saw the significance of that.
Now, what's interesting about the self-denial of power is it is so rare, but it is not surprising in the American Republic, because genius was all around, and he let the country develop for 4 years, and then he reluctantly went to Philadelphia in 1787, and he reluctantly, if we are to believe his first inaugural address, we have about a minute to the break and we'll come back, he reluctantly accepted the presidency. I've always had two minds about that, Dr. Arnn. What do you think? Did he want to be president, or did he have to be president?
Well, I think he generally didn't want that. He wanted to be a commander of the Continental Army.
Yes.
And And we don't. We only know that because of an action. On the day they were going to pick the commander, he put on his uniform. And he attended the sessions and other days in civilian clothes. And he looked magnificent in his uniform. I think he was telling them something, right?
He was 6 foot two. He was taller than everyone, too.
That's right. Yeah, he was a very physically impressive man, very handsome man. And so he goes, and anyway, but yeah, I think he's, he doesn't like the tug of politics, right? A very indicative story about him is that he informed James Madison that he and others that he wouldn't be going to the Constitutional Convention. And the reason was the Society of Cincinnatus, which is named after a Roman general who won great wars and retired and went home. That's it still goes today, and that's the society of people who served in the Revolutionary War, old soldiers.
Hold on. We've got to take a break. Hold on to the side. This is important. It's important. Don't go anywhere, America. Washington's first inaugural address and his farewell address coming up. It's the Hillsdale Dialogue. All things Hillsdale are at hillsdale.edu, including applications for students who you think could actually benefit from education. I'll be right back with Dr. Arne.
You're in the middle of a nonstop, action-packed information blitz. The Hugh Hewitt Show is coming right back.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Dr. Larry Arne is my guest. The Hillsdale Dialogue is underway. Last week we talked about, or the last Hillsdale Dialogue, we talked about the French Revolution. We're contrasting it now with the American Revolution and how it produced a workable government. Because largely of the genius of the men assembled in Philadelphia and the division of power, but also because of the execution of that plan under the guidance of Washington, who originally didn't even want to have anything to do with the convention, which is where we left off, Dr. Arne.
Yeah, well, Washington had a powerful sense of what? Of honor. And so he didn't want to do anything that was shameful. Or even looked shameful. So the Society of the Cincinnati has become controversial. It's being accused in the newspapers of being a elitist or aristocratic organization. And so he decides not to go to a convention that they're having. And he's the man, right? He's just like in the Constitutional Convention. But then he thinks, if I'm not going to go to that, I don't want to embarrass the Society of the Cincinnati. And so if I go to the Constitutional Convention and make an appearance, that will make them look bad. So I won't go. And James Madison reads that letter and gets on his horse. Rides from Montpelier into Mount Vernon and talks him into it. Because they couldn't go ahead without him.
When they got it ratified, and we talked two weeks ago about the ratification, they have to select the president. It's obviously Washington, and he proposes his first inaugural address. And there I want to turn now, because it's marvelous, but it's also ghostwritten, isn't it?
Well, yeah, you know, and James Madison wrote drafts of it, at least. And George Washington was a very formidable man, too. He had a big hand in it. I've always said that it's not a good thing to have your speeches written by a speechwriter, but if you could get James Madison to do it, that would be okay.
Yeah. Now, he references in it the almighty being who rules over the universe. He referenced in it the great author of every public and private good. He comes back to the agent of all of our beneficence. He's obviously a deist. Is he a Christian?
Well, those are not obviously deistic things that he's saying, and yes, he is a practicing Christian, and there's a lot of evidence about that from all kinds of people, that, you know, he was a praying man, and he attended services regularly. Jefferson, there's reason to doubt that he was an Orthodox Christian, let's say, but these, you know, just remember, you can say if you want to, when you believe that there's, if you say that there's a working of nature that is regular and that is reflected in the movements of the heavenly bodies, well, that's just an observation, right? That's Aristotle thinks that too. He's not a deist. It emerges that he was even wrong about some things in the movement of the planets, but he's not wrong about the relationships that are demonstrated by the movements of the planets, and that there's some continuity in nature, including in human nature. So Washington thought that, and he's, and remember, one of the reasons that language is good is because you don't want the clergy, like the French clergy, by the way, being partisans in political battles, because they can call down the authority of God, yeah, and that besmirches their station, right? And so in America, we've worked out a language about the divine that encompasses everybody, you know, the laws of nature and of nature's God, that encompasses what we know by reason and what we know by faith. And on the philosophic or theological levels, those things can contradict each other. Faithful people believe because our reason is limited. But on the moral level, those things agree. Or have agreed in forever, just not lately. So the point is, then Washington is using a language that calls a high or ultimate sanction down for the way of life that we are called to live. And we can all live under the discipline of that. And that's, you know, it's just what a wonderful expression is.
And he lived it out. People know his letter to the synagogue of Newport. He also, a Catholic church I occasionally attend, was endowed by Washington, St. Mary's Basilica in Old Town Alexandria. It's a great church. If people are in Northern Virginia visiting, you should visit there. And he attended the Episcopal Church. He was buried in the Presbyterian Church. He was rather quite ecumenical in his affections for congregations. I want to go back to the inaugural address, though. He spent some time talking about party and faction. And this is, I think, probably, you referenced it in the last segment. He brought everyone together, but as soon as he left the scene, it broke apart.
Well, broke apart, yeah. I mean,
into factions, not the government, but the unity.
They don't want the thought of the American founding. If the word party comes up in the sense of political party, that's a bad word. In the Federalist Papers, everywhere, right? And yet the people who wrote all that literature formed political parties immediately, and they did it because the later view, my view, and other people who are right, the later view is that you need them in America because movements expressing the will of the people have to coordinate the branches of government. Right. So both the left and the right have plenty of stuff they'd like to do to the government today. Neither of them can do it unless they have a political party that can elect people to Congress and the presidency and the state legislatures and the governorships. Right. Now, you know, I think that there's a move in Washington to change that so that the federal government becomes the sole power. And, you know, I think that that's not the only thing that's going on. I also think that the Congress has created a large bureaucracy that actually makes our laws and does supplant in different ways both the executive and the judicial branch and legislative branches and to some extent the judicial. So, but the point is, if you're going to have this system where power is distributed all over the country, which it is, then there has to be some system for assembling that power, you know, in some way so it can cohere to make the needed changes or to sustain the needed policies.
Now, you know,
so
I don't believe
political parties.
I don't believe the governor. I was with the governors last week in Nashville and the Republican governors. And I do not believe they are at all inclined to give over to the federal government. And I actually don't believe the American people are at all inclined to give over to the federal government. And that German historicism that you talked about as maturing or seasoning up in the French Revolution and in Rousseau's work. That's the spirit of the administrative state. That's the scientific stuff that infects everything. But I don't think the governors are inclined to give up anything. And that's no. to our good benefit.
Yeah, and see, that's both conviction and interest. And one can rejoice that both those things are operating because it makes them stronger. If you're Ron DeSantis, I mean, I think he's a fine man, he's a great man. He's done some awesome things, right? Bob Lee in Tennessee, I know pretty well. I admire him very much. Well, the thing is, they have a principle that Tennessee and Florida ought to get to govern themselves, and they have an interest in the truth of that principle because it makes them stronger. But second, they might get elected to national office on that argument, and that could be a powerful argument for running for national office.
In fact, Governor DeSantis,
some of them are getting ready to do that.
We might have the clip available. I don't know if we have cut number one from last week of Ron DeSantis on Sean Hannity's show using a line which I think will be heard a lot. Do we have that handy,
John? Well, Sean, I mean, some will, but I think the majority won't. I think what we've seen over the last year are people fleeing these lockdown states. And I think the fact that Florida, I said today that we were basically like the nation's West Berlin, people coming in to be able to get a respite, people come and uprooting their lives and coming to Florida for more opportunity. So I think you got a lot of people who really are seeking freedom. They're seeking a better life. And I think once they get here, they're very impressed with the quality of life that we offer. Sean, your state of New York, you guys are taxed to smithereens.
Whoa,
your budget,
don't blame me. It's not my state. I have no say in this state.
All right, so Larry, I think it is a overstatement that illustrates. It's not West Berlin, because you could get there without being shot. But what he's trying to say is, or shooting at you, and you're not killed if you fail to get to Florida. It's illustrative, though, of the different approaches. And his state went a different way, and it was the right way to go, as opposed to your state.
You know, There's a bill been introduced, I don't know what its standing is, in the California legislature, and it would collect state income taxes on your income for 10 years after you left the state.
It's unconstitutional as the day is long.
A little bit more like East and West Berlin, isn't it?
Yeah. And, it's another step in that direction. They still won't shoot you when you leave, like I left, but we'll come back and finish there, because at the farewell address of Washington, the bridge between them both, he's still upset with parties, and yet they come. Dr. Larry Arnn, the Hillsdale Dialogue continues at all things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu.
This is the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Welcome back, America. Last week we tossed the French Revolution. This week we begin the week by talking about George Washington. I'm going to try and track down Roberts to talk about Napoleon, because Washington's the bridge between them both. As he leaves office, Larry Arnn, 8 years after that first inaugural address, he warns again about party. How much does that have to do with what has happened in France, and how was Washington impacted by that revolution?
Well, but you know, they're against parties before France went crazy.
Yes.
And they, you know, what they want is they form a constitution, right? The genius of the American Constitution is that it sets up biases in the political system. And the bias is that if we're after something personal or prejudicial to the public interest, if we're a faction in the definition of James Madison and the Federalist, it's hard for us to get much influence because it's a big country and you got to talk openly to influence it, and because you got to talk in a lot of different jurisdictions to a lot of different interests. But then on the other hand, when a national interest is at stake, then you can get energy behind it because, you know, the government does need to be energetic and do decisive things often. So that's the bias they set up, and they think that parties, they see them mostly in the light of attempts to become majority factions. And, you know, I mean, I think, by the way, that there's a class of person in America who are the avant-garde, and they tend to be richer and better established and more sophisticated than us rubes. And they kind of act like a ruling class these days. And that's a faction, I think. And I fear it, by the way. But so Washington feared things like that, too. And it's very interesting, you know, about these guys, that the people who made the American Revolution and then governed the country for the next 30 years, those people were on top of the world. And it was not their purpose or their action to solidify their own rule. In fact, their greatest acts are acts of distribution of power across the land, you see. And that's a public-spiritedness. Lincoln, and see, George Washington wants to preserve that, right? He wants people to be public-minded, and their personal interest is taken into account, but it's not supreme. These guys are so great, in my opinion, that Lincoln, in his first really great speech in his life in 1836, the Lyceum Address, he says that the founders had an interest in the system of free government they erected because they erected it. And because it could, you know, then we can be 200 plus years later having this conversation about George Washington.
And there is,
imagine that.
In this address, says, there's some, go ahead.
Yeah, Lincoln says in that address, he says that when people come along later with the spirit of those people, what does he call the something of the lion and the tribe of the lion and the something of the eagle, he says, then they might have an interest in tearing all that down, you see. And that's sort of what's going on in some ways today. Anyway, Washington is a man of huge imagination and a love of honor that doesn't, however, will not. It's a philosophic understanding of honor. He won't be, he wouldn't enslave anybody. He wouldn't enslave the people of America. He would liberate them, including ultimately his own slaves. So that's, that eruption is what produces a system of free government. And, you know, if you look at the deep controversies in the country today, I'm on a side in those controversies. I try to style myself or place myself on the side of Abraham Lincoln and the founders. But another way to look at the thing is this is a test whether the political institutions of the country can hold, you know, as they did not hold in France and as they did hold here, although they had to be heavily adapted, in the American Revolution. Can we preserve our political institutions, which serve their purpose, right, is to produce stable policy based on public opinion?
He warned about foreign influence, which is what Mike Pompeo, Tom Cotton are running around telling everyone. Foreign influence is a great danger coming from the CCP. And Washington warned about debt. It's really interesting to read his inaugural. We got 30, 45 seconds left. It's really, do you teach the farewell address, Larry Arnn?
Oh, yeah. It's in these things we're reading today. Well, the Washington things, at least. They're in the Constitution Reader, too, right? So there's three related core courses. There's the Constitution course that goes through the political history and documents of the country. There's this American History Reader that we're reading from now. And there's the Ancient or Western History Reader that's a whole semester. And so those overlap a lot.
And with good reason that I think inaugural address and farewell address are in both of the American ones. Larry Arnn, next week we'll continue to talk about which way America went, which way France went in the form of Napoleon, in the form of Jefferson. America, thank you. The Hillsdale Dialogues are all available at Hugh for Hillsdale.com. All things Hillsdale at Hillsdale.edu. Stay tuned.
You absolutely, positively need the truth. This is where you turn. This is the Hugh Hewitt Show.